This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 385 was produced on July 20, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. When crude oil started showing signs of a bullish breakout last week, I told you we really needed to get Dr. Anas Alhaji back on the show for another update, since he told us on his last interview to expect the market to turn bullish in the second half of this year. So Anas returns as this week's feature interview guest, and we'll discuss everything from an update on his market outlook to why Chinese reopening didn't have the demand recovery effect so many of us predicted.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week as of the close of Wednesday, July 19th, 2023. The S&P 500 futures up 226 basis points to 4609. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. U.S. dollar index down 27 basis points to 100 spot 3. The Dixie consolidating after last week's heavy breakdown. The September WTI crude oil contract down 33 basis points to 75.29. We'll take a look at that chart in the postgame, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data. Gold up 97 basis points, closing to 1981, trading now towards the round number resistance at 2000. Copper down 104 basis points to 381, continuing to consolidate in a multi-month range. Uranium up 54 basis points, closing at 55.85, and the U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 11 basis points, closing at 3.75, back to the June trading ranges between 3.70 and 3.80. The key news to watch, we are getting into the heart of earnings season, and next week we have global PMIs and the FOMC, ECB, and the Bank of Japan monetary policy statements. This week's feature interview guest is Dr. Anas Alhaji. Eric, why did we invite Anas back to the show as a guest this week?
Well, Patrick, last time we had Anas on the show, his call was to expect the market to turn bullish, but he was very careful to say, don't get excited too quickly. It's not in the first half of the year. It's in the second half of the year, and probably not till the fourth quarter. Well, that's only a couple of months away now, so I wanted to get an update on his outlook, but I also wanted to talk longer-term supply-demand outlooks, because what I see on the horizon is a global energy crisis in the mid-2020s. Which will result from misplaced climate activism pressuring financial institutions to refrain from financing oil and gas production projects. But that's my take. I want to find out what Anas sees and compare that with my own outlook.
Well, Eric's interview with Dr. Anas Alhaji is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Dr. Anas Alhaji, managing partner at Energy Outlook Advisors and noted keynote speaker on energy markets. Anas, it's great to get you back on the show. I'm really excited to get an update for you on your outlook on energy markets. For the benefit of any new listeners who may have missed our prior interview, Anas basically has nailed this market, saying to us, look, don't get too excited, even though I think Anas and I agree very much in the longer term about a bullish outlook. Anas said, don't get too excited in the first half of 2023. It's not time yet. If we're going to have a big bull run in crude oil, it's not coming until the second half. So far, that's definitely proven right. So, Anas, I just can't wait to get you back on for an update. You nailed that call. What comes next? Is it time for this market to finally turn up? Why didn't Chinese reopening recreate demand as everyone expected it to? And what should we expect next?
Thank you very much, Eric. It's always a pleasure to be on Macro Voices. It was clear from the beginning, if we look at how countries open after lockdown, that we are going to have an increase, a sharp increase, simply because of the transportation sector. But for the rest of the economy to pick up, it takes time. So aside from all the ills of the Chinese economy, it's just the fact that these things take time. So the idea that we open up tomorrow and everything is back to normal is not what happened. So we expected that we have increased in consumption because of the transportation sector, and then the economy will kind of improve little by little over time. So we were not that excited about China. But the issue that some analysts basically fell into the trap of what the Chinese government did after reopening. As you know, because of the long period of the lockdown, many students, and of course they are in tens of millions, got locked away from their families. And the same for soldiers and policemen and others. So they stayed away from their families for a very long time. When the government opened up, they literally chartered thousands of planes and buses, et cetera, to move those people so they can visit their families. Some people look at that as, look, this is back to normal and this is what the trend is. But it was a one-time thing. And then we go back to normal in the transportation sector. But for the rest of the economy, it's not that much. And we ended up with a situation now. And now, since you mentioned that we nailed it on 2023, today we published a report on, it's the first look at 2024. And we pointed out two issues that we overlooked in our outlook for 2023. And I think the both lessons that we learned from this are lessons for everyone. So we were really bullish on the fourth quarter of 2023. That's our view. We are still bullish, but not as bullish as before. Why? Because we never expected the Chinese to build their inventories the way they did in the last 3 months, which is very dangerous because we've seen them doing this before and we've seen them releasing this as oil prices go up.
Hang on a second. Please elaborate on what you mean. What has happened in the last 3 months?
The Chinese basically built their inventories significantly, the commercial and the strategic petroleum reserves. So they are almost at a billion barrels right now. For both.
They're buying every drop of crude oil they can get. As long as they have a tank with space in it, they'll buy some more.
Correct. But the issue here is that people confused demand with consumption. Demand is not consumption. The difference between demand and consumption is the storage, which means that their consumption was way lower, but they were storing oil. And those who did not know the difference, they looked at imports and they said, oh, look, the Chinese economy is growing. Look how much oil they are importing. Well, a lot of it basically went to storage. And therefore, the economy was not growing as fast as those guys thought. But for us, for our outlook, the existence of this extra oil kind of destroyed our view of very bullish on the fourth quarter. So we are still bullish, but we are not very bullish anymore. And the reason why, because we've seen the Chinese releasing oil from the SPR and releasing oil from commercial inventories, because in China, even commercial inventories are really strategic reserves anyway, because they are mostly owned by the government-owned companies. So if oil prices go to, let's say, 80, 85 and stay there, we will see the Chinese releasing probably 80 million barrels from the SPR in the next few months. And therefore, we are not going to see the spike in prices that we were expecting in the fourth quarter.
You're saying China has been building its SPR for the last 3 months, and you expect them to release 80 million barrels that they've just built in coming months? I'm missing something.
Yes, up to 80 million if prices go up. If prices do not go up, they will just keep them. They will keep buying. But if prices go up and the market gets tighter and prices go higher than what we are. And the reason why we are talking about 85 and higher for releasing the SPR, because historically they released the SPR anytime Brent went above 70. So now, because they are buying the cheap Russian crude, the average for them is different from the past. So the threshold is no longer 70 Brent. It's higher than 70.
So you think that China has been spending the last 3 months aggressively building their stocks of oil, and if oil prices go higher, it makes perfect sense to me that then they might start to reverse that. But you're saying only a little bit higher, only, you know, into the 80s, 90s. I would have thought they'd hold out for $150 before they would start reducing their storage.
Based on our studies, the threshold was 75, and then After looking at the data in 2021, we found out it is 70. And now, because they are getting the cheap Russian crude, they that threshold got messed up. So it's a bit, it's higher than 70. But the idea, this is one of the ideas that we missed. We never talked about the Chinese basically building the SPR the way they did. The other idea that we missed and we learned from it the hard way is we knew, and we talked about your show the in the previous interview, how oil producing countries are buying oil and products from Russia. So OPEC Plus basically are buying from each other in a sense. We talked about that. But what we missed was this trade in reality was way, way larger than what we expected.
And how much larger is it? And where did you get the data now that you didn't have then?
Last time, we did not have enough data. Remember, the sanctions, the European sanctions on petroleum products imports from Russia started in February. I think our last interview was in March. So there was not enough data to see what the impact of the ban is. So what the Russians did basically is they literally scrambled all over the world, tried to find markets, small and large, etc. But we found out that the large oil-producing countries are buying a large amount of products from Russia. And the reason why this is important, because Saudi Arabia, for example, or other Gulf countries can literally cut their production in the summertime, which is no one could have expected, because their power demand for oil increases in the summer. As you know, that power burn, because they need a lot of electricity for cooling. And that increase in the Gulf basically could add up to 700,000-800,000 barrels a day in the summer. And sometimes in a tight market, that comes at the expense of exports, which means that exports decline and oil prices globally increase. What we see now is something different, where they are cutting production. They are not worried about the power burn, because they are importing the Russian high sulfur fuel oil to burn in their power plants at a very cheap prices. That's another point we did not forecast. We were not able to. We learned it the hard way.
Honest, let's move on beyond the immediate time frame to longer out. Something you and I have agreed on in the past interviews, at least, has been that this ESG trend, which has almost criminalized institutional investment in oil and gas exploration and production, is going to result in a major energy crisis in future years. We were kind of perceived as crazy conspiracy theorists to think such things when we first started talking that way. Now, JP Morgan has jumped on board with a very similar view in a recent research note, where they're projecting a shortfall of 4.2 million barrels per day of crude oil production by 2030. Now, honest, bear with me if I get technical here with my terminology. There's no effing way that anybody on Earth has 4.2 million barrels of spare capacity. If OPEC turned up every screw they could possibly turn, nobody's got an extra 4.2 million barrels of capacity until somebody invests in building it, which I don't see happening. Where is this all headed, and what is your outlook longer term, and when does that start to happen in markets?
Strangely enough, their 4.5 million shortage is very close to our numbers that we produced last year. And the issue here is this. Once you move from a static model to a dynamic model, which they did not do, you end up with a better picture than what they are showing. And the reason why, once oil prices increase, they reach a level where we end up with demand destruction. And that demand destruction will eat most of that shortage they are talking about. So the issues are, in my view, are not really the lack of investment. If you look at 2022, the increase in investment in 2022, one of the highest in the history of the oil industry. That's the rate of growth is one of the highest. So the industry responded. If you look at what Total Energies and Shell did in last 2 months, as you know, the other side are attacking them big time because they're reneged on their ideas, and BP too, that they will cut their investment on oil and gas. And now they said, no, they are going to go back to the original plans. It seems they knew even before the JP Morgan and others that this is what's going to happen. We are going to end up with shortages. And I really advise everyone to read or listen to what the CEO of Total said about this, because he was the most eloquent person to do this last week on CNBC. And for those who wants to read it, by the way, we already published it in last week's report, and we are publishing it today in the Daily Energy Report. We are publishing his statements. He just stated that in a very beautiful way, that, look, if we don't focus this way, we are going to have a major energy crisis and a lot of people will die. I mean, that's the conclusion of everything he said. Of course, he said it more eloquently than the way I am saying it. The issue here is, if you look at the media, even the Financial Times published 2 days ago an article that goes against ESG. That was unimaginable just a week ago. So even the media is changing. Why? Because the governments, the European governments, practically changed on the ground. They went back to coal. They went back to wood. They went back to fossil fuel. They literally spent billions of dollars subsidizing gasoline and diesel in their countries. They are giving consumers money. And that's why, by the way, gasoline consumption in Europe went up, because of those subsidies. So they already, on the ground, they changed their attitude. The companies saw that. So when we look at the oil companies' behavior, we should put it within that framework. We have a major change globally. The whole sentiment and narrative is changing. And then if you look at what India is doing and China is doing and the oil producing countries and what the African leaders are saying, you can see that the narrative is changing. The European narrative is no longer valid. No one believes the European narrative anymore. So we will get more investment because the narrative is changing. And I strongly believe that this COP28 that's going to be held very soon in the UAE is going to be a significant event in the history of the energy industry and all the environmental business, because the narrative is going to change. And once that narrative changes, we will see people coming back. In fact, there was a piece of news today talking about a big fund basically changing their policy, just dumping ESG and coming back to invest in oil and gas. So the narrative is changing. We have no problem. We can catch up with investment. My fear, and this is part of our long-term outlook, my fear is that no one is going to pay attention to the failure of some of the climate change policies that, by default, the moment they fail, the moment they don't deliver, the demand for coal, oil, and gas is going to increase. By default. And the other related point is, by default, with the failure of those green policies, governments and companies are going to switch to natural gas because it is the natural choice for them under the climate change policies. And therefore, the demand for natural gas in particular is going to be way, way higher than current forecasts. The demand for oil is going to be higher than current forecasts. And that's where the energy crisis is going to come from. It's really from the unexpected increase in demand that no one is counting for.
And when you say that there's going to be an unexpected increase in demand and nobody's counting on it, is the reason that you say nobody's counting on it because you think that people who are counting on a reduction of demand, thanks to what I think you and I might agree are unrealistic expectations they have about how quickly green energy is going to come on to replace it. Is that the reason, or is it something else that's leading you to that conclusion?
No, that's exactly the reason. Because if you look at every single long-term outlook, they are taking government wishes and saying, this is the outlook. Well, we have over 100 years of thousands of books and articles on government policy failure. Why we talk about government policy failure when it comes to COVID, when it comes to health, when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to immigration, and all of a sudden, when it comes to climate change, it's perfect.
Okay, well, that will sort itself out in the political arena. We can't do too much about that. But what I want to understand in this interview, Anas, is let's imagine that people finally maybe came to their senses and realized that you can't phase out fossil fuels before phasing in viable replacements. And I'm all for phasing out fossil fuels, but you got to have the replacements first. We don't have the replacements. Let's suppose we came to our senses about that and we realized, okay, we are still going to have demand growth because as much as we would like to be replacing fossil fuels with green energy, we haven't made any progress on building that green energy. And until we do, we're stuck with fossil fuels. We're going to need more of it. We don't have it. What's going to happen? Let's imagine that even the ESG investment trend finally gets rectified and comes to its senses. What I'm not seeing is where more production can come from, even with investment, without a really long time lag. And the reason I say that, at least as I understand how the market works, you're far more expert on this than I am, is that for all of history, or at least for all of my lifetime, for the last 60 years of OPEC existing, the way things have worked is that OPEC's always had plenty of spare capacity. And if they wanted to, they could increase production. And of course, they don't always want to. That's a negotiation and so forth. But when they want to, they can increase production. And there's still a lag time. It takes a while before prices can come back down. But with time, they can bring the price back down. I think we've gotten to a point where OPEC has almost completely run out of spare production to where they can't do anything. There's nothing for OPEC to do other than to say, yeah, nothing we can do either. Prices are going to keep going up until it leads to enough demand destruction to balance the market. And I think that's where you have energy suddenly completely strangling the entire global economy because energy becomes too expensive. So where is this going to come from? I mean, it seems to me like we've kind of seen shale oil growth go pretty much as far as it can go. Maybe there's another million barrels a day there in U.S. shale. I don't know. Maybe there's some offshore on Guyana, a couple million barrels eventually there, but that's only going to make up for decline. Where's that 4.2 million barrels from 2030 going to come from, even if we came to our senses?
Sure. So if you look at some forecasts 3-4 years ago, with ESG and all those wishes by the government, some forecasts basically were predicting that global oil demand will reach 105 million barrels a day by 2030. So only 7-8 years from now, basically. But by that time, it was a decade. And simply because they said, look, EVs and this is going to replace this. People have to realize that based on the current forecasts, we are going to hit 105 by the end of 2024, 6-7 years earlier. So the crisis is really near in this case. It's really near. So looking at 2024 balances, which a report that we released today, and it's really amazing to see that world oil demand is going to hit a record in 2024 under any scenario. Is going to hit a record under any scenario.
When you emphasize any scenario, why are you emphasizing that? Do you mean even in a significant economic recession?
Yes, because we still have about 17, 18 months to the end of the, well, about 16 months left to the year. And a recession usually does not last that long. But even if you count for that, because the recession wipes out growth, the decline in demand does not exceed 300,000-400,000 barrels a day, and that's it. So after the recession, everything builds up again. So under any of those scenarios, we are going to have a record demand no matter what, and that's 105. We are going to reach it sooner than earlier expectations. And what is amazing about 2024 is the presidential election. The presidential election is going to cast a shadow on the oil market. Trump and Biden, both of them entrenched themselves in their positions toward the oil market. So oil is going to be an issue in the elections no matter what. And the option of using the SPR becomes a big issue. Probably we'll talk about the SPR later on. But the issue for 2024, because you are talking about the long term and the 4.5, I'm trying to show you it could be way earlier than that. If OPEC maintains its cut as promised until the end of 2024, given that the demand is going to reach 105, we are already going to be short 2 million.
Well, and it seems to me, Honest, that before 2028 or so, and I don't know exactly, it's very hard to time these things and get it right, but definitely before 2030, we're going to get to a situation where I think it's 1973 all over again, where what's different is it's not about, like, say, 2005, where energy prices get so high that, you know, gasoline costs $6 a gallon. Everybody in a very strong economy at a time when people are making a fortune flipping houses, you know, gasoline costs a lot. So when you drive to the job site where you're making $100,000 flipping a house in 3 months, you know, it cost a lot of money in 2005 to fill your gas tank. Well, you had plenty of money to burn. Now we've got a completely different economic situation. And I think we get to where the cost of energy prevents the economy from growing and locks the economy into recession that stays in recession for several years, as happened in the 1970s energy crisis. Is that too extreme, or is that consistent with what you see coming?
Okay. There are certain points that the listeners need to know. What we are seeing right now in the oil-producing countries, yes, we have the spare capacity grew as Saudis and others cut, so we have a certain spare capacity. But counting that spare capacity on its own is not the right way of doing it. And the reason why, because those countries are spending massive amount of money right now or renewable energy and switching to natural gas, and some of them already went to nuclear, which means that their domestic consumption of oil is going to decline. So we have to count the spare capacity plus the switch from domestic consumption to exports. So we do have a lifeline there in those countries. That's number one. Number two, we have the Arctic now with all the eyes on it. If you look at Norway, basically, at the beginning of last year, they opened up 136 fields, despite all the environmental objections and all that stuff. And we are not even talking about Russia in this case at all. China, just last week, finished building the first icebreaker. So, in a sense, we still have areas to go to. But most of that 4.8 that you are talking about will be demand destruction. We cannot handle high prices. So there will be demand destruction.
And I think that is the fundamental difference that I'm talking about, is there's an economic phenomenon which is the cost of energy gets more expensive. And therefore, because it's more expensive, you know, it hurts the profit of everybody's business and it just drags the economy down. Then there's a completely different equation, which is there's not enough energy, and therefore the price gets bid up to some level that stabilizes it, that creates enough demand destruction. It means that people who need energy aren't getting it. And the market's mechanism is not to say no to anyone, but instead to just increase everyone's price to the point that some people say no to themselves. But it's still preventing the economy from recovering as it did in the 1970s, as opposed to other times when we've had high energy prices that just, you know, contribute to the high price of everything else. What we had in the early 70s was energy, and energy crisis was literally the thing on everybody's mind because it was stopping the economy from moving forward. I think we're headed back into that in the late 2020s.
I'm going to be the devil's advocate here. I don't agree on using the example of the 70s, because really what destroyed the economy at that time and caused the shortages and all that stuff is really price controls, which we don't have. That's number one. Number two, on the second part of this, we have to pay attention to what happened in 2007 and 2008. Oil prices almost reached 150. And yet we had one of the best economic growth rates between 2004 and 2008 until the financial crisis happened in Europe, in the United States, in China, in India, and many of the Asian countries, despite the $150 oil. What the conclusion, what the lessons we learned from it is, if you have the right fiscal and monetary policies to go with that crisis, then you can mitigate most of it. The problem is, if our politicians and our officials in the Fed and the central banks do or adopt the wrong policies, that's where the problems are. But we do have evidence from history that if we have the right fiscal and monetary policies, we can handle or mitigate the impact of higher energy prices.
Anas, let's come back to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which you brought up a little bit earlier in this interview. You and I have talked about this before, and I think we've tended to agree on most of this in the sense that when a lot of people were saying, okay, in the spring of 2023, get ready, guys, because there's going to be a huge bull market in oil because the U.S. is going to be refilling its SPR. I think we both kind of chuckled and said, don't count just because they said once that they were going to do that on it really happening. I didn't think they were going to refill it, but I also didn't think they would continue. I think we're at something like 15 consecutive weeks now of drawdowns continuing against the U.S. SPR at the very time of year when we were originally promised that the Biden administration was going to be refilling what they had drawn down last year. So what's going on here? Where's this headed?
The first thing that people must know is that the refill rate of the SPR, and I'm talking about technical issues here, is very low. That's why the government is buying 3 million or 3.2 a month, because it takes a month to inject the 3 million into one site. So whatever they do in terms of refill, and of course, this 12 million barrels that they bought some and they are planning to buy this fiscal year, has no impact on the market anyway because it's a small amount. But even if they go for 60 and 90 million, the impact is very limited because this will be over a long period of time because the injection time, it takes a long time. So let's settle this point that the impact of the refill is very limited. It's not like you just bring a whole tanker of 2 million barrels and dump it in one day. It does not work that way. The second point is, it is very clear, as we discussed in the past, that they want to refill with medium sour crude. And a lot of people do not understand the requirements for the SPR because many Canadians were saying, look, we are here, buy from us. Well, the conditions are very clear. The first one is it has to be American-produced oil. And it has to be medium sour, which means that shale producers will not benefit from it. And some people say, yeah, but we can blend it. Well, the second condition is the oil into the SPR cannot be a blend. It has to be original crude, no blending. And therefore, because it's American, we exclude Canada and the rest of the world. And because it cannot be blended, we exclude shale and others. So most likely, all of it is going to come from the Gulf of Mexico, because that's where most of the oil that matches those conditions is. The third point, which is kind of very interesting, that we really, and I hope that there was an effort basically to have an open congressional investigation of this. And I really would love to see it, now, although it's costly, but it opens up so many things here. We really want to know what the technical status of the caverns are and what happened after the drawdown, and why it's costing billions of dollars, basically, to maintain and revamp those caverns. And the reason why I'm saying this, because I have no evidence, but there is no commercial sense of buying those 12 million barrels. There must be some other technical issues related to that. It just does not make sense. You release 221 million barrels in 2022. That the 180 plus the congressional mandated amount, and then you go and buy only 12. For the SPR to make perfect sense, oil prices have to be low. I'm talking about the refilling of the SPR. Oil prices have to be low. And based on our calculations, probably 43 or lower for WTI to make sense to buy and refill the SPR.
Do you think the SPR, the U.S. SPR, will ever be refilled fully to its, let's say, back up to more than it was at the beginning of the Biden administration, 600?
No. Basically, they already kind of expressed their intentions, and it's very clear. First of all, we don't need to. And the reason why, because if you look at the SPR when it started in the 70s, and then the President George W. Bush, after September 11th terrorist attack, he ordered to refill it to 700. At that time, we did not have the shale revolution. The share revolution came in 2010 and added literally 8 million barrels a day of sweet crude. 8 million every single day, every single day. So why I need sweet crude if I can, if I am producing more than what Saudis export in one day?
Anas, I'm a little concerned by your statement that the rules require refilling the SPR with American-made oil and that blending is not allowed. And the reason I say that is it seems to me like the worst thing we could do is refill the SPR with the same kind of light sweet crude that we have abundantly already in the United States. Because the whole point of the SPR is if our imports got cut off, that we wouldn't be screwed. So what we need is the blend stock. We need the medium and the heavy to blend with the light that we can get from U.S. producers.
Technically, when you are storing oil for years, you cannot have a blend. It's a technical issue. It's not a political decision.
Okay. So where are we going to get oil to refill the SPR that's not light sweet? And what's the point of having light sweet in an SPR? You know, what does that accomplish?
I think we are going to end up with 2/3, 1/3, which means that 1/3 is light sweet just in case of emergency. The 2/3 is going to be sour.
And where does the sour come from?
The sour is going to come from the Gulf of Mexico. And let me remind you of one thing that's very important. How did George W. Bush refill the SPR? He did not buy a single barrel. What he did basically is, and of course, the Department of Interior, they literally forced the companies to pay royalties in kind. So the royalties the government was collecting, instead of money, the companies were giving them the oil. And they literally built the SPR from the royalties from the Gulf of Mexico.
So the government cut a deal with the oil companies saying, we'll give you a lease and allow you to drill your oil wells here. And instead of paying us dollars, you can pay us in barrels and just put them into the SPR so the country has them in the piggy bank. That was the deal.
It does not have to be in a lease, basically, because companies that have been already producing before that, they can ask them to tell them, look, from now on, give me in kind, don't give me money. It does not have to be part of the lease. But the idea here is we filled the SPR in the past from the Gulf of Mexico, and we can do it now. The Gulf of Mexico is producing between 1.8 to 1.9 million barrels a day. So we do have a lot of oil coming from there, and all of it almost is sour. So we can get that. And the idea here, and the listeners must realize the following. I want to go back to your point because it is a very important point. If you look at U.S. imports today, the 6 to 7 million barrels that we import from overseas, about 97 to 98% of it is sour, which means that if we have disruptions overseas, we need a replacement and it has to be sour. At the same time, we have hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico. And historically, we have companies that are producing in the Gulf of Mexico that borrowed oil from the SPR because they couldn't produce because of the damage from the hurricanes. So the disruption is coming from the Gulf of Mexico, which means that, again, it's sour. So the refill is going to be all sour, simply because all the risks are in sour supplies.
I want to move on to another topic, which is dark shipments. A little bit of background just for any listeners who may be unfamiliar. All ships at sea have a device called an AIS transponder. Its purpose is not so much to track oil markets, but to stop ships from crashing into each other and sinking in the middle of the night. It's basically allowing a ship to digitally transmit a signal that says, this is who I am and this is where I'm going, so that other ships can see it on radar and know not to crash into it. They're turning these things off on us and basically going back to the 1800s when ships were passing in the night secretly and nobody knew who was passing and they crossed their fingers not to crash into each other because they're trying to prevent being tracked because there's so many dirty deals going on now to skirt sanctions. What are the impacts of this? How's it going to affect the market? And what does it do to the quality of data available to us?
Generally speaking, as you know, the Iranians perfected this game over the years. Then the Chinese came in and added technology to it. So they reached kind of the level of perfection of how to work with these things. However, when Russians decided to do the same thing, they took a page from the Iranian book, and the Chinese basically came with it, and they helped them do it. This brings us to another point, because this point is very important, and it's been in the news today and in previous days. What happened is, when the Russians invaded Ukraine and they knew that their oil is going to be embargoed, they started looking for other markets before the embargo and before the price caps, before any of that. So to shift, if you look at the map and look at northern Russia and look where China and India is relative to Europe, the distance is like several times the distance to Europe. And there were only a few ships running that route. So the shipping cost basically went through the roof. And those shippers basically made a lot of money. China and Russia realized that if they want to work this out, they need to bring more ships. And because of the sanctions, a lot of ship owners are afraid. So they decided to go on a shopping spree around the world, and they bought over 1,000 tankers. That's between China and Russia. But most of it, basically probably about 60-70%, are bought by the Chinese. And the objective is to bring them from around the world and literally work this route out. So they did. Of course, what happened is, when you take this out of the global market, the shipping cost outside that area will go up. And the shipping cost within this area is going to go down. So the Russian discount that was $30, more than $30 at one point, was not because of the sanctions. It happened before the sanctions and before the price cap, simply because of the shipping cost. When they brought in those hundreds of ships or tankers to the area, the shipping cost declined substantially. And therefore, look at the Russian Ural price. The recovery in it was amazing and exceeded $60 now. It exceeded the price cap. It exceeded the price cap not because of the increase in oil prices substantially. It is because the shipping cost declined. And now what we see is, India basically is talking to Iran and telling them, look, I need some oil. Give me some discount. I can just get rid of some of the Russian oil, and I can get Iranian oil. Of course, they contacted Saudi Arabia and UAE, others, and those countries are already increasing their prices. So they have no interest in giving India a discount. So they are left only with Iran. But the idea, to go back to your point here, is we have hundreds of ships, hundreds of tankers basically taking the Russian oil, in addition to the other tankers taking the Venezuelan and the Iranian crude too, the same way. And we don't know much about them. That led to major data deterioration. We already know from 2017 until now that data deteriorated significantly. But with the Russian invasion of Ukraine and then the sanctions and the price cap and everything else, the data deteriorated significantly in the oil market, to the extent that any journalist right now in any newspaper can write any story with any numbers, and they can prove to themselves and to their readers they are correct. Because we really don't know. No one knows what the correct numbers are. We don't know. Add to that the EIA until now couldn't figure out a way to reduce the adjustment number, as you know, in its weekly data, which increased significantly since last year. That's data deterioration too. Then add to it other issues related to the threshold, even within OPEC members, between what is condensates and what is crude, is really kind of, no one knows really where the boundaries are. So a country can exceed the quota and literally tell OPEC members, oh, by the way, that was condensate, so you should not count that.
Well, Anas, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to come back. You said earlier that you have two reports that you recently released on your Substack. For anybody who's not familiar with your Substack and what you do at Energy Outlook Advisors, please tell us what's on offer, how people can find out more. I know that out of respect to your paying subscribers, you can't tell us everything that's in those two most recent reports, but maybe give us a quick overview of what subscribers can find there. And if there are any samples of prior subscriber materials that you can share with our listeners, I'm sure they'd love it.
Thank you, Eric, for this. We do have Energy Outlook Advisors weekly newsletter. It's not really weekly. We publish several reports with that. There are several reports included in this. Today, we published a report on the outlook for 2024. And it's just a summary of what the expectations are and our point of views, etc. Last week, we published a very significant report that gained a lot of media attention. On the title of it, basically, is Back to Earth, Reality of the Energy Transition. And we have 11 charts, basically, and it's showing that this idea that some countries are going to reach carbon neutrality by 2050 or 2060 is a complete nonsense. And please allow me to mention two points that are extremely important. The first one is the increase in energy demand in recent decades is really significant. Any way you look at it, whether the amount or the rate of growth, it's just amazing. So you look at since 1965, the global energy demand increased by fourfold. That the energy. The problem is this trend is going to continue. And what that means is even if developing countries trying to catch up with the climate change policies and they invest in renewables, the investment in renewables is barely kind of meeting the growth, which means that renewables are not replacing fossil fuel. So that's the first important point. The second one is, since 2010 until now, the world spent more than $4 trillion on renewable energy, and that's excluding hydro. More than $4 trillion since 2010. That $4 trillion, just to put it in context, more than the GDP of Africa and the Arab world in Asia combined, which means that it does include some huge economies like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa. Yet, if you look at 2022 world primary energy consumption by source, so this is the most recent data and very close to us right now. What is the percentage of renewable energy out of the total energy consumption after we spent $4 trillion? Only 7%. Only 7%.
It's up 2% from less than 5% last year.
But still, the idea here is we have 93% or at least, let's say, 80% that we need to take care of. And we spent $4 trillion to get... not the 7%, because 3% already existed before that. So we have 4% only. We spent $4 trillion on that. And if you look at it from electricity point of view, because this was total energy, and this is what really kind of shocking, only 14% of the global energy, the global electricity generation, only 14% came from renewable energy. So the idea here is we have 2050, it's very close. There is no way we can achieve carbon neutrality with this. Here is a final statement. The number one country in terms of investing in renewable energy is China. China is spending on energy more than anyone else, and the difference between China and the second country and the third country is huge. Yet, for China to achieve carbon neutrality, it needs $38 trillion. Based on current spending, China needs more than 210, basically it needs 211 years. 211 years. And that assumes all the current projects basically will stay forever. No maintenance, and they just stay there, and they have no limits on their lifetime. You look at India. India needs 350 years.
Well, honestly, look forward to getting you back for an update in a few months. Patrick Zarezna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Zarezna.
Eric, great to get an update from Anas. Looking forward to talking about the oil chart. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to that chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Anas's picture that says, Looking for the Downloads. Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with those EIA inventory data.
Breaking news just in. The Biden administration did not recklessly pilfer any more oil out of the SPR this week, which would have been the 16th consecutive week if not for the pause. Kidding aside, it's going to be really interesting to see whether this is a pause or if they're actually done looting this strategic national asset of the United States. Crude oil drawing down 708,000 barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down a massive 2.9 million barrels. I have to apologize. I've been away from the market because we've been shooting my energy documentary this week. So I don't know what the news is, but normally when you see that big of a drawdown in Cushing, it usually means there's been some kind of disturbance or anomaly in the physical distribution network. There was some oil that was meant to be pipelined into Cushing this week that didn't get there for some reason, is my best guess. Gasoline drawing down 1.1 million barrels. Distillates drawing down a de minimis 14,000 barrels. U.S. production holding unchanged at 12.3 million barrels. We're right at the make-or-break point for crude oil. The continuation 200-day moving average is at 77.21. That's the ceiling above the market. A sustained breakout above that level would be massively bullish on a technical level. But from Anas's comments in the feature interview, it might be too early to expect that. And right here at the 200-day moving average is where we peaked in April after the surprise announcement from Saudi Arabia and OPEC. Of course, that was a higher dollar price back in April, but it's the same moving average. So on a technical level, a failure here could spell one final retest of the lows before the market finally turns around in Q4 or even Q1 if you go by Anas's fundamental outlook timing. But a sustained breakout above 77.21 on WTI would suggest that the market is forward-looking enough to already be discounting the fundamental factors that Anas described as affecting the market later in the year. So, Patrick, I'd love to get your take on how your technical interpretation jibes with mine and what specific levels you're watching on crude to tell you when the final bottom is really in and when it's time to start buying all the dips aggressively.
You know, Eric, sometimes when we're talking oil and, you know, we can talk some of the short-term fibs and some of the technical signals that are occurring, but I really wanted to step back and really zoom out and see a bigger and very important trend that has happened over the last year. You can see crude oil peaked out in June of last year, and we've been in more or less a one-year bear market in oil. And really, it was in July of 2022 where we had a breakdown of the 200-day moving average. You know, and some famous traders like Paul Tudor Jones swears by the 200-day moving average as a, you know, depictor of trend. One can see that oil has basically remained for an entire year below its 200-day moving average, including now two direct tests into that 200-day moving average. And that 200-day moving average today is trading at $77, a level we were just at last week. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether we finally see a bullish breakout of this 200-day moving average and whether this bear market decline that can be defined by that shifts. Have we broken above it? No. But and that's what I think makes it a really interesting thing for many of our listeners to watch, because I think that oil progressing towards the April highs, $80 plus, and then we see a pattern of higher highs and higher lows and some sort of signs of accumulation as the old dips are being bought. If we see those characteristics, that could create a second half of the year rally that could have us, let's say, testing 2022 highs from the fourth quarter, somewhere near $90. But let's watch that 200-day moving average and see how it plays out. Nonetheless, Eric, what are your thoughts here on equities?
I think a retest of all-time highs above 4,800 on the S&P is now far more than 50% likely. The reason is that with this much upside momentum, and particularly with this week's acceleration in the rate of price appreciation after last week's breakout above the 61.8 Fib retracement level, my take is that if you want to express a bearish fundamental view, the technicals are telling you that you probably better wait for a double top, and you might even want to wait for a move to new all-time highs above that top, wait for the blow-off top that Darius Dale predicted before you actually try to short this market, because it looks to me like you're going to get run over if you try to do it here. Thinking longer term, it's time for all of us intermediate term bears to at least recheck our assumptions and figure out how this market already got to almost new all-time highs, so that we already have our plans made when that actually happens, and I think it's coming soon. A whole lot of very, very smart Macro Voices guests in recent months have echoed the same message that the final bottom isn't in yet for this bear market. And if they all got that primary market call about the bear market bottom not being in yet wrong, and they got it wrong together, well, that probably means that we all got some other stuff wrong together too. So we should all start reevaluating our assumptions. Personally, I'm trading gold and crude oil markets actively and quite happy to pass on equities until my own technical and fundamental views start to align with one another.
Yeah, I want to talk about the charts on the S&P here in just a moment, but let's get Nick in the conversation. Nick, what levels are you watching? I mean, we have option expiration this week, obviously. Sometimes gamma pins in there, but it really hasn't stopped this market from trending. You're now starting to watch the August OPEX, right?
That's correct, yeah. So right now, Patrick, the spot price on SPX is 45.65. We have a call wall above at 4,600, which is also a key area of resistance. We have a put wall below at 4,300. This is for this coming Friday, July 21st OPEX. Now, the implied move for the August 18th OPEX is 120 points up or down. So the upper expected move is 46.85, and the lower expected move is 44.45. Key areas of support right now are at 4,500, 4,400, then 4,350, then 4,300. Now, right now, I do think we're overextended a bit.
I couldn't agree more with you, Nick, and just in terms of some short-term overhead resistance. But what I have on page four is simply a chart that depicts where those 2021 and 2022 highs came in, right around this 4,600, and then the other high much closer to 4,800. Now that we've beaten all fib zones, these previous highs obviously are short-term magnets that traders are often targeting. But we've already had such an enormous run. The only thing to observe is that even if you're skeptical about the sustainability of this run, to me, what I see is that there's no evidence that the bulls have in any way dropped the ball on this drive. Like the momentum continues, there's no reversal candles, no topping formations, no key breaks of major support lines. Patterns like buying quick dips are happening over and over again. And so really, we can be skeptical about the short-term resistance levels, but there's simply no reversal sign yet. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be paying attention to it with such an overextended market on the short term. I think it could very easily trigger a sell cycle, just no sign of it yet. Moving on, though, to the NASDAQ here, Nick, what levels are you watching on the Qs?
Spot price right now on QQQ is 383. We have a call wall above at 385 and a put wall below at 370. The implied move for the August 18th OPEX is plus minus 16 points. So the upper expected move is 399, just below that key area of resistance at 400. And the lower expected move is 367. The next key area of resistance is at 409, which is at the all-time highs for the NASDAQ. And key support is at 370. So right now, as I mentioned in previous weeks, I do think that tech is very overextended, and I'm favoring the small caps over big tech. And that's proven to be a pretty good bet so far, because we've seen the Russell outperform tech pretty handily over the past week or so. And I expect that to keep up over the next few months as well. And moving on to the US dollar index on page six, guys, what are your thoughts here?
Well, it seems that make or break is in vogue this week because, as I said earlier, that's where we are in the crude oil market and that's where we stand with the dollar. We saw that breakdown below 100 on the Dixie last week, which could portend an outright drop much lower if that level doesn't hold. But then, just as we should expect in technical analysis, we got a nice rally back to retest that same 100 level on Wednesday, but this time as resistance rather than support. A rejection here, and particularly a daily close below 99, would signal a dollar breakdown. A sustained move back above 100 could mark the beginning of a significant bullish correction, negating the fake breakdown below 100 and flashing a new bullish signal. But for right now, the name of the game is to watch closely what happens next. A break above 100 or below 99 will be the tell for the next leg, and that's a much narrower range, so it should resolve quickly.
Eric, since I was using that 200-day moving average on oil, I thought it would be appropriate to also bring it in here on the chart of the U.S. dollar. And what's interesting is that we were holding quite an important support along that 101 level, which also was very close to a key Fibonacci zone. That was an area that I speculated could act as a key support for an intermediate period. That clearly has now broken. And you can see that we're now on a sustained basis below that 200-day moving average, making lower highs and lower lows. This is a very weak market that is continuing to break down. This is going to be really interesting to see whether or not we start heading back to 2021 levels. I mean, if we see any type of a sustained breakdown here that continues, that while it certainly would be weak for the dollar, it certainly would be actually a bullish tailwind on a lot of other risk assets, particularly commodities. And so what will be interesting in my mind to see whether this US dollar trend continues, because it certainly could be the tailwind that things like gold, oil, copper, and so many more other commodities may need to just actually have some sort of a bull impulse.
Now, on page 7, we have the gold futures chart. What are your thoughts here?
I think gold is still trading as a reciprocal play on the dollar to a large extent. The market may be starting to discount the fundamental driver of this new BRICS reserve currency, creating additional demand, but frankly, I doubt it. I think the gold bounce is probably just all about the dollar breakdown, and as we already discussed, the dollar is at a make or break point, so when the dollar's next leg becomes clear, gold's going to follow in the opposite direction.
Eric, staying with that same theme for the whole chart deck, I left that 200-day moving average. Unlike other commodities, gold actually has always remained a stone throw away from its all-time high. We put in that high back in 2020, retested in 2022, and retested again earlier this year. This entire pause in the gold advance has really just been a consolidation wedge. Notice it stays above its 200-day moving average, and overall, was not a very deep pullback relative to the pullbacks we saw both in 2021 and 2022. What will be really interesting to see is if gold can get above 2000 and start retesting those all-time highs again. If it's staying above its moving averages and working up there, it certainly could be the conditions that allow gold to make a major breakout. Will that we see that? That's certainly something that remains on my mind. So then moving on to page 8, what I really wanted to do different in today's chart deck is actually talk about today's market conditions, because they're very unique. Today, Nick, we have an environment where we have multi-year lows on volatility premium on options. The short vol community is back. You have a lot of cover call writing, overwriting going on. You have obviously historically low realized volatility levels that have been dragging volatility down, which generally the way that our listeners can kind of relate to that is that it generally makes options cheaper. And we have not seen volatility this low in many, many years. And so on page 9, we have that VIX chart. The VIX, our volatility index, measures 30-day volatility, which is always a shorter time frame. This is why on the next page I have a longer dated one. But I mean, you have to basically now go back to 2017 to 2019 to see levels this low on volatility. And it's really interesting because overall, we still have a monetary policy where the Fed is basically trying to fight asset prices, raising interest rates, trying to generally slow the economy. Typically, one would think that this is a period that would have heightened volatility, but yet here we are with very, very low volatility premiums. I find it so interesting.
Right now, we have a period of low volatility that's being driven by complacency by investors predominantly. And typically, what you see is you see these explosive moves to the upside in volatility, typically driven by some kind of catalyst event. Now, we don't know what that event is right now, but looking at the historicals over the past few months for as they pertain to monthly OPEX. So just for reference, the last 5 monthly OPEX is post-OPEX, the following week's returns are as follows. So for the February OPEX, the following week, we had a minus 3.52% drawdown in SPX. The March OPEX, we had a pop of 2.21% following the monthly OPEX. The April OPEX, we had a decline of 2.08% following the monthly OPEX. The May OPEX, we had a decline of 2.26% following that OPEX. And the June OPEX, we had a decline of 2.5% the following week post OPEX. So this coming Friday, which is tomorrow, is very important because if we do close near the highs again, I think we see a short-term pullback. And that's where you might have that window of weakness. It might be short-lived perhaps, but these are the key areas where you can take a pretty high probability trade based on statistics. And so looking at the volatility index right now and seeing how cheap insurance is right now, because there's less demand for it, primarily because a lot of market participants are choosing to go with long calls versus long equity, which is more cash efficient, capital efficient rather, we could see a nice pullback of 2 to 3% in a pretty fast time frame. Also factor in that next week we have FOMC as well on Wednesday. So there's a confluence of factors here at work, you know, between the historicals on post-monthly OPEX, FOMC, and then also, historically speaking, the first 3 weeks of July are very, very bullish. We're exiting that window the first 3 weeks of July. So we're pushing into that August lull where a lot of the algos take over and everyone's on vacation.
Well, you know, it's interesting to say that the other factor beyond the FOMC, we have three central banks. We have the ECB and the Bank of Japan, which is a lot of questions about their yield curve control, but it's also the heart of the earnings season. And really, this entire rally has been an expansion of multiples. We haven't seen corporate earnings in any way uptick. And this is why I think this corporate earnings cycle is going to be so important, because if companies start to disappoint or fail to rise in a way to confirm these very bullish price action in the market, that could be the conditions where we have this period of stability lead to a new period of instability. And it'll be interesting to see whether the next few weeks become the start of that. On page 10, though, I have the six-month volatility index. So just to put that in context for those that are not familiar with it, it's simply saying when you're going 6 months out and you're pricing volatility premium, what is that? So it's a longer dated VIX, basically. And what you can again see is that whether we did one year one last week on the chart deck, but here's a 6 month one. Again, we're not far from that incredibly low vol condition in the 2017 to 2020 period that led to some very violent volatility that came in the last 3 years. The key, though, that I want to talk about here, Nick, is that today's market conditions are incredibly unique. And I'm going to do a special webinar for free for any of our listeners that want to attend in terms of the option strategies that work ideally in these types of market conditions. So let's kind of go through what these market conditions are. We have multi-year lows on volatility premium, making options generally the cheapest on a relative basis that they are, especially if one was to believe volatility will return in the second half of the year. The second thing is we have incredibly high interest rates. And the third is we have trending equity markets. I mean, we had in the last 9 months, essentially the S&P 500 rise 30% or like close to 1,100 points higher and is relentlessly rising at a period where it's all multiple expansion and not supported by earnings expansions or at least earnings growth. And the interest rates are now at an interesting crossroad. And one of the reasons, or I want to bring up the interest rates here, Nick, is that if you look on page 11, I have the 3 month SOFR futures. This is the September 2023 contract, which is showing close to a 5.5% yield for where interest rates are. But what's interesting is when I show on that top right hand corner where the SOFR futures are for the different quarterly expirations going for the rest of this year and next year, they are basically anticipating the high of interest rates here in the coming months, and that interest rates will, even a year from now, be 1% or more lower than where they are today. And so we are at a moment where, at least based upon the way SOFR futures are trading, we are seeing peak short-term interest rate, because long-term bonds like 10-year and 30-years, they may still fluctuate based on other variables. But at least in terms of short-term money, we're seeing a peak. The interesting part about that is the influence of interest rates on option pricing, particularly the fact that when a row is working for or against you in the option Greeks, especially for longer dated options or that have to factor in more interest rates, when interest rates are rising, like we have seen over the last year and a half, it basically contracts put options and makes call options more expensive to factor in the arbitrage. And so there's a whole array of interesting ways of playing options in the index markets to complement these types of interest rate forecasts. So if you believe we are seeing peak interest rates and you believe that interest rates are likely to decline in going into next year, at least on the 1 and 2 year duration bonds, there are certain option strategies that benefit from it. And so we have this condition here, Nick, where we have very cheap volatility premiums, an interest rate environment that is favorable to certain types of options, and we have a stock market that is extended and very mature. Now, there is no evidence that a top is going to come in right here, right now. But if you believe that inevitably, after whether it's a month or 2 months from now, and whether it's 200 S&P points higher, if you believe at some point there is a risk that there is going to be a 20% drop in the S&P 500, and there's a good chance that inevitably it happens, and you're looking for a low-cost, low-risk way to hedge and protect your portfolio against these kind of conditions, that's exactly what we're going to be covering on this webinar. So on July 25th at 1 p.m., I'm going to be hosting a special webinar on the option strategies perfect for today's market environment. And I'm inviting all the Macro Voice listeners that want to attend completely for free. You can register at bigpicturetrading.com/money, or there's also a link included in the chart deck.
Folks, if you want to learn about the option strategies ideal for trading and hedging today's market conditions, you can find the link in the Research Roundup email or on the last page of the chart deck. You can alternatively go to www.bigpicturetrading.com/money. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K. And follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.